Each year, 350,000 women die of cervical cancer, a disease that my guest is on a mission to eradicate. In her new book, Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer, Dr. Linda Eckert informs us that this disease is 90% preventable. Dr. Linda Eckert is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology with an infectious disease fellowship at the University of Washington. She's an internationally recognized expert in immunizations and cervical cancer prevention. Dr. Eckert has worked at Seattle's Harborview Hospital for more than 30 years. Welcome to The Exchange, Doctor.
Thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, I'd like to start this segment with an excerpt from your book. If you could just read the two paragraphs that we talked about.
Thank you. Okay. So, I am a woman raised in the Western United States, in a country where I had the opportunity to go to college and medical school and pursue advanced medical training. I am white, and I am talking about a disease that kills more women of color. In addition to working in medical clinics in my own country, labeled high income by the World Bank, I have lived and worked as a physician in Liberia, Nicaragua, and Kenya, countries deemed low income. And while I'm a passionate advocate for those who've been attacked by this cancer, I am not a cervical cancer survivor. I've never had to fight to obtain health care. I am acutely aware that my perspective arises in part from a place of privilege. I own my perspective as a physician who has provided patient care to women for decades across many countries and within communities filled with women of varying needs and financial means. Caring for women and bearing witness to their courage as they confront illness, witnessing their immense power as they birth children, and being privy to their deepest concerns and moments of profound vulnerability, my role in these women's lives has been and continues to be my deepest privilege and my greatest inspiration. I am a fierce believer in the power of women.
That's a very powerful statement, Doctor.
Well, thank you. And I think I feel really privileged that I have had a life that has allowed me to witness the immense strength and power of women.
So help us understand the scope of the problem.
Well, cervical cancer is a disease that kills a woman every 2 minutes in the United States, every 2 hours in the United States and every 90 seconds globally. So it is also a disease that's rising. It's a disease of equity. It strikes people more commonly of lower resource settings, more commonly in rural areas than urban areas, more commonly people of a color than not, except in certain areas. And it's a disease that's almost entirely preventable, which is so rare if you think about saying preventable and cancer in the same sentence. And so I finally just got so angry of watching this disease and how it impacted people and their families and their children and their communities that's why I decided to write this book.
So let's start with your own discovery in the chapter you call The Vision. It was at a 2003 symposium. Tell us about it.
So I was sitting in a room at University of Washington for Grand Rounds, which is a weekly conference where you hear the latest, greatest discoveries. And I just remember distinctly this moment of sitting in Grand Rounds where I heard the first reports of the initial research on this HPV vaccine and the fact that it had led to almost 100% reduction in precancer of the cervix caused by the HPV-16 type, which is the most common cervical cancer-causing type in the world. And I remember being struck by that so drastically since I have seen the devastation of cervical cancer and thinking, wow, we're on the verge. We're on the verge of an amazing journey that's going to really help to eliminate this cancer. And isn't this going to be wonderful? And I have to get to be a part of this journey.
So Early in the book, you introduce us to two women who left an indelible mark on your memory. The first was Maria. Tell us about Maria.
So I was working in Nicaragua when I first finished my training. I was about 30 years old, and we were in a rural part of the country, and we were set up this shop, a medical shop, essentially, to handle some acute problems in a school. And Maria was in the line to see me. There were a few of us providing care, and she was being brought to me in a wheelbarrow by her husband. And as she came close, I could see that she looked very thin and very pale. And we had a few beds set up where we could do examinations if we needed to. And so I helped her husband move her to a bed. And when I did, I noticed that she had a dark purple stain on her clothing and also on rags that were in the wheelbarrow that smelled of old blood. And as I talked to her, and she told me about the fact that she'd been having bleeding for months that wasn't necessarily associated with periods, and that she never had a pap smear, which is very common in that part of the world, I became fearful right away that she had cervical cancer. And so I asked to do a gentle exam where I could place fingers in her vagina and feel the top of her vagina, which is where the cervix is. And sure enough, there was this large mass there that I was fairly certain was cervical cancer, although I didn't have the equipment available to look with a speculum light or to do a biopsy. And I remember telling her husband that, you know, I want her to be able to go to Managua, to the main hospital, so that she can potentially get a biopsy and get treatment. And as her husband left, you know, she looked at me and she said, "Doctor, do I have cancer? Am I going to die, essentially?" And I remember saying to her that I was very fearful that she probably did have cancer, although I couldn't confirm it, but that was why I wanted her to go to the center. And, you know, she had small children. She wasn't going to really be able to access care that was going to offer her any extension of her life or much less save her life. And she just quietly sobbed for about 10 minutes. And then she sat up, and I helped her sit up. She was very weak. She looked at me, and I could tell she understood. She understood that her life was going to be ending soon. And it was this profound moment of loss for both of us. So actually gives me tears just still thinking about it so many years later. So I watched her husband wheel her off in a wheelbarrow with her feet, you know, hitting the ruts of the road as she bounced off, and I never saw her again.
Such an extraordinary story. My guest is Dr. Linda Eckerd, author of Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer. You can join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Doctor, tell us about Susie.
So Susie is a story from Seattle. This is many years later now, about 15 years later. And I was working in the women's clinic at Harborview, which has been my medical home for three decades. And Susie came at the end of the morning because she'd had bleeding and a discharge that had lasted for quite a few months. And when I went in to see her, I didn't have a lot of records because she was an urgent add-on appointment. My medical assistant stopped me at the door and said, you know, there's a strong odor in the room. And so as I walked in the room, I smelled this odor. And Susie also was embarrassed. It wasn't lost on me that she was feeling shame about this odor. She was looking down at the floor. And as we started talking, she told me that she'd had, you know, this discharge that had come for several months, and she was worried about it, but she kept thinking that it was because she'd had some bleeding, it was going to go away. And eventually, I found out that she hadn't been able to obtain care in about 7 years. She had moved, she didn't have insurance, the low-cost clinic where she'd been living previously in Colorado had been forced to shut down. And she previously also had been traumatized. She'd had a sexual assault. And so coming for a pelvic exam, it was exceedingly difficult for her. I was worried because of her history. She had swelling in one leg. These are all signs of advanced cervical cancer. And so when I went to do her examination, I had one of my colleagues come into the room. And she also noted the smell. And the smell is the smell that happens when there's essentially tissue that is dying from cancer at the top of the vagina. And it's a very distinctive smell. And if you've cared for individuals who have cervical cancer, you recognize it. So she recognized that odor as well. And when I did the exam, yes, I did see a tumor. I took a biopsy of it. And I told her that I was concerned it was likely cervical cancer, but that we could get her treatment. She, of course, was very, very shocked. And I just remember her hand holding my hand as I was telling her this and her tears and just my thought that, oh, my word, here this is another woman that's going to be impacted so greatly by this disease that I know is preventable.
Doctor, you have so many stories in this book that are similar in nature, that are just heart-wrenching. How do you deal with it?
Well, I think the heart-wrenching aspect of it is absolutely true. And that is one of the things that brought me to write this book. But I also feel like I get hope from these women. Many of them have gone on, you know, to receive treatment, like Susie. She's still alive. That's not her real name. And, you know, I'm still in contact with her. And many of the women who've had cervical cancer that I interviewed for the book actually offered me resilience and courage because they have said, you know, yes, this terrible thing has happened to me. And I have been impacted greatly by it, but I don't want it to happen to other people. So I'm going to share my story. I'm going to allow a perfect stranger who was me to put it in a book because I want other people to know that this is a preventable cancer and we can do something about it. So in some ways, these stories became very empowering to me and also taught me a great deal from being with these women and having the privilege of sharing their stories.
Doctor, you wrote, quote, "To prevent cervical cancer, we must understand not only how to prevent it, but also what gets in the way of preventing it," end quote. What do you mean?
So cervical cancer is a below-the-belt cancer caused by a virus, human papillomavirus, that is caused by sexual transmission. So in our country, we have a very hard time, and actually globally, I would say, talking about diseases that are associated with sex. They carry a lot of stigma. Everybody I interviewed for this book talked about the stigma. It didn't matter if they were a Google executive in New York or they were in rural Zimbabwe. They all spoke about how they'd been impacted by the stigma of this disease. And so because of that, you know, unlike breast cancer, which people have overcome that stigma and talked about it, cervical cancer is still stigmatized and difficult for people to talk about. And so that's one component. Another component is just, I think, women's healthcare in general is undervalued. And, you know, we know that it hasn't had the research or the public health funding or the messaging that it could. And so I think that's another obstacle. And another obstacle is access. We have crisis in our country for low-income people accessing healthcare, especially in rural areas. And we have inability to offer the full prevention measures for screening and then treatment for follow-up of abnormal smears or abnormal tests equally in our country and as well as globally. And so I think there are many obstacles that get in the way.
Well, we're going to get to some of those obstacles because there's a lot to talk about. And you have a section called Talk, Talk, Talk. You have another section about a question, what is the value of women's lives? You have a discussion of the inequities inherent in the system. And we're going to get to all of that. Doctor, you were alluding to the inequities in the system. And you write in your book that 90% of the women who died of cervical cancer in 2020 lived in lower-income countries. But there are pockets of regions in higher-income countries with the same cervical cancer rates as lower-income countries. Why?
I think, well, that's a complex answer, and I will do my best. One is, a big one is access to care. We've had a lot of rural hospitals and clinics closed down because of cuts in Medicaid funding, and I'm afraid we might be headed that way again. And so access is a big challenge. And there was just actually a recent study out yesterday, actually, documenting that cervical cancer is increasing for women who live in rural areas compared to urban areas. I feel that another challenge we have is that screening requires, you know, a pelvic exam typically in the past, and that this is sometimes unwelcome to individuals, and there also might be a lack of knowledge about how important it is. We have this amazing tool of the HPV vaccine, but it's also, if you don't have health insurance, and if you...
You were talking about the HPV vaccine. Did we lose her? Okay, I think we lost her, but we're going to get her back. Dr. Eckerd is a doctor at Harborview Hospital in Seattle. And one of the things that I wanted her to talk about that she writes in her book is, she says, HPV is more common than you think. And I'm just going to quote from her book very quickly. I was working in my clinic in Seattle one Thursday in May. As I scrolled through messages in my patient care inbox, Jennifer's name popped up right away. She'd sent me three messages. The first one, from early in the day, noted that her pap smear results had come back atypical. It also says, I have this high-risk HPV DNA positive result, she wrote. What does this mean? 4 hours later, Jennifer had sent me another message. Can I ever get rid of this? Who gave this to me? Finally, just a couple of hours after the second message, I saw Jennifer's third message. This one let me know her underlying fear. Dr. Eckerd, am I going to get cancer? Doctor?
Thank you for reading that story. And I feel like that's some of the most common conversations I have.
Well, the hospital where you work, Harborview in Seattle, offers care for women without health insurance. And you write that such service is rare. I don't understand that. Isn't the healthcare industry designed to give healthcare to everybody?
Yeah, actually, in our country, we have this mismatch of, or, you know, I'd say a conglomeration of ways to get healthcare. And most people get, if they have private insurance, their employment, then they do often have options for healthcare. If they do not have private insurance to be offered through their appointment, you know, through their employment, a lot of people can access health care through the Affordable Care Act, but it still costs money, and many people have to make hard choices about what to do with their income, and not everybody can afford health insurance. And then if you can afford health insurance and you come for a pap smear, unless you can access a low-cost clinic, and those clinics have been shut down, especially in the South, where a lot of clinics have been eliminated, such as Planned Parenthood. It really is a matter of, can I afford to pay for this? And then if it's abnormal and you need a biopsy or you need further treatment, that's additional cost. So I would say no. We live in a country where many people cannot access health care.
My guest is Dr. Linda Eckerd, author of Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer. And you can join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Doctor, you have a chapter called What is a Woman Worth? And that's a provocative question. How do you respond?
I wrote that chapter because studies have shown how cost-effective it is to prevent cervical cancer. Not surprisingly, prevention is usually much cheaper than treatment. But the World Health Organization has done this amazing thing. They've launched this global cervical cancer elimination effort, which is a very profound statement on their part because they've never tried to eliminate a cancer and they've never tried to eliminate a disease that strikes just those of a single gender. They did cost-effectiveness studies and found for every dollar spent on screening, $26 was returned back to the economy because you kept the woman in the workforce, but also because of all the unpaid work that women do. You know, they run their organizations, they care for their families, they care for their elders. And so this is a 26-to-1 return on healthcare dollars, which is an incredible, really wonderful public health investment. And so I just wanted to make that point in this chapter that, you know, women are worth so much to their communities, their families, their children, and they're also worth a lot economically because, let's face it, people make tough decisions about how they're going to spend their healthcare dollars, and this is a really good decision to make, to spend it preventing cervical cancer.
And prevention is the primary goal of your book, but HPV isn't the sole source of cervical cancer, is it?
It is actually the source of about 98 to 97% of cervical cancer, depending on what study you read. It's a really unique cancer in that we know what causes it, and we have tools that can prevent it. And so other HPV cancers, for instance, throat cancer, is about 70% caused by HPV, HPV 16, that can also be prevented by the vaccine. And so but cervical cancer is almost all HPV caused.
And does it mean that someone who contracts HPV will ultimately contract cervical cancer if they have a cervix?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And the wonderful answer is no. There are many types of HPV, and there are, of those many types, there's 12 types that are called high-risk or cancer-causing types, oncogenic types. It's those high-risk HPV types that we test for when we do HPV DNA testing, for example, as screening. And in those high-risk types, there are HPV type 16, which causes 50% of cervical cancer globally, and HPV 18, which causes another 20%. And so even within these 12 high-risk types, there are a few types that are the most dangerous, and those are the types that are actually protected against by the HPV vaccine. So most people who get HPV, their body gets rid of it on its own. And it's only if you, and that's like over 90% of the time that happens. So it's only if you catch HPV with one of these high-risk types and it sticks around for usually a few years and your body isn't able to clear the infection, that then you can develop precancer and cancer. But even then, we can find precancer with cervical cancer screening and treat it so you don't develop cancer. So there's a few ways we can actually prevent the cervical cancer.
So, Doctor, you also write this, quote, "This correlation between poverty, race, and lack of access to medical care and the consequent rise in diseases like cervical cancer is abundantly clear in the United States," end quote. It sounds like a societal contradiction to me. On one hand, the United States boasts that it has the best medical care in the world. But on the other hand, the data you're providing suggests that such world-class health care is reserved primarily for the white and wealthy in America. So I'm wondering, does that mean a significant portion of doctors, hospital administrators, medical researchers don't really care about certain humans in our population?
Gosh, I think our healthcare system is designed to A, offer interventions better than prevention, and B, it is insurance driven. And so people who have access to insurance do have access to a different level of care. So I don't know that I would say people don't care about it. I think that's a hard statement to make, but I would say that we prioritize, we may have priorities in our health care. And caring for individuals who don't have private insurance or who live in rural areas or who may, you know, be have skin that is not white isn't how our healthcare system is designed. It's designed more for urban areas, more for people with private insurance. And those are the people who have the best access to the best care.
In one section of your book, you encourage women to talk. So talk about that.
Yeah, thank you for that. I feel like this is really one of our superpowers. You know, I think there is a lot of misinformation that happens around cervical cancer, around HPV. You know, why is a disease that, you know, 80% of adults who will acquire HPV, essentially if you're going to have sex, you're going to get HPV at some point in your life and it's going to clear. So why is it so stigmatized? And how do you take down stigma? I think a big part of it is talking and telling stories and realizing that, oh, yeah, this is really common. I can talk about this. And I also think that, you know, public health prevention, some of it comes clearly from the top down. We get messages from the American Cancer Society or CDC and so forth. But a lot of it is peer-to-peer, talking to our friends, saying, oh, gosh, you know, I had my son vaccinated against the HPV vaccine. Do you have any questions about it? That's what I used to ask about on the soccer sidelines when my kids were playing soccer. So I think we have actually a lot of power by using our words and talking about disease and learning about it and then spreading the word that we can do something about it.
So what do you want people to take away from this book overall?
I think this book is a book of hope because we have hope that we can really make a dent in this cancer. We have work to do. We have inequities to overcome, as you have so eloquently pointed out. We have challenges. We have misinformation. But what we also have is really great compelling data. For instance, Australia is about to eliminate cervical cancer within the next 10 years, probably. Sweden's on the way. And even in our country, precancer in our young women is dropping. There was just recent studies about that. And so we have a lot of hope that we can offer, but we need to help educate others. We need to advocate for access. And we need to use the stories of people who've been impacted by cervical cancer and don't want others to have the same fate. And so I hope my book offers all of those things.
You have a section in your book that says, time to join the collective cry. What do you mean?
I do mean essentially what we were just talking about, like every piece of information that goes out, every discussion with health class at school about are they teaching about HPV, every decision about vaccination that you talk about with your friends or your peers, those are all ways that we can join the collective cry that says, let's do this. Let's get rid of a cancer in our lifetime that harms so many people. Even if they don't die, the treatment leaves people sterile. It has really awful side effects from radiation sometimes. And we can do better. Women deserve it. We deserve it in our culture to do better. And we can join the collective cry to say we've had enough, which is why I called my book Enough.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for writing this book, Dr. Eckert.
Thank you for allowing me to talk about it and to talk about HPV disease and how we can prevent it.